Her name is actually Beulah, so.
Mm-hmm. She lives with Hazel.
She lives with Hazel?
Mm-hmm. Beulah and Hazel. That's going to be on the tape.
Roll the tape, Beulah and Hazel. My name is Ingrid Christiansen. I'm teaching here for a few weeks. I live in Chicago ordinarily. And I'm going to read a story tonight by Alice Walker. I like reading Alice Walker's stuff for many reasons, mostly because I'm enchanted by most of what she writes. But I also like the fact that she was born in 1944, which is the same year I was born. So I feel like there's some sort of kindred spirit. I'll do the math for you. I'm 45, and so is she. She, however, went to Sarah Lawrence, and she is, I think, a really brilliant window for me into the Black community. I think people who are willing to write about their community, their heritage, and share it with the world are a gift to us all, and I want to acknowledge that. I don't think it's so easy to be able to be objective enough about your own history that you can be a meaningful window for other people to see it. When I read this story, Everyday Use, I always think, for some reason, of my Grandma Bew. I'm Norwegian, and Grandmother Bew made me a Norwegian doll when I was a late teen, when I was leaving home to go to college, and gave it to me. A Norwegian doll, a nissa, for those of you who are familiar with that culture. And she made this nissa so that it looked like a Norwegian doll and gave it to me. And I said, but Grandma, is it Norwegian? Is it real? Is it really Norwegian? And she was a little impatient with me and said, Ingrid, I'm Norwegian, which meant, you know, get with it. I made this doll. I'm Norwegian. It's a Norwegian doll. It's a nissa. What do you mean, is it real? I didn't buy it in a store for you. I didn't go in Moorhead, Minnesota to the Norwegian shop and buy it. I made it. But that story comes to mind when I read Alice Walker's window into this aspect of the Black community that she's going to share with us in the story. There are a few little things that I'd like you to kind of keep in mind while you're listening. She does a real play of history and the present, and she makes history come alive in the present. She shows how history means something in the present, and I think we all know that in our own lives, and we could talk about that later. But in terms of heritage, she's really looking at her heritage and talking about how it impacts this family that we're going to hear about. She uses an image a lot that's fun to pick up on as you're listening. It's an image of light. And it comes out in many ways: light, color, flame, dark glasses, dark colors. So that you'll hear that repeatedly through the story. She also plays with names some. She plays with, there's a mother and two daughters in the story. The mother is a very conscious user of names. When she names someone or when she changes the name of someone, it's for a meaning, a use. It impacts the flow of the story. And one of the kids has a theory about names that we'll hear about. So the names of things and their history are all part of what makes this story work. What I see in this thing all the time, and what I guess I meant by Grandma Bew, was that all of our heritage impacts who we are as human beings. And we have to kind of figure out how to use that and what that means for our generation and for the next generation. And those are all things that Alice Walker's looking at. And obviously the heritage of someone who's been kidnapped and brought to this country and then had generations of slaves before they became free, and then free generations, all of that history impacts that family, just as it would any of our families if it had happened to us. So it's called Everyday Use for Your Grandmama. I will wait for her in the yard that Maggie and I made so clean and wavy yesterday afternoon. A yard like this is more comfortable than most people know. It is not just a yard. It is like an extended living room. When the hard clay is swept clean as a floor and the fine sand around the edges lined with tiny irregular grooves, anyone can come and sit and look up into the elm tree and wait for the breezes that never come inside the house. Maggie will be nervous until after her sister goes. She will stand hopelessly in corners, homely and ashamed of the burn scars down her arms and legs, eyeing her sister with a mixture of envy and awe. She thinks her sister has held life always in the palm of one hand, that no is a word the world never learned to say to her. You've no doubt seen those TV shows where the child who has made it is confronted as a surprise by her own mother and father, tottering in weakly from backstage. A pleasant surprise, of course. What would they do if parent and child came on the show only to curse out and insult each other? On TV, mother and child embrace and smile into each other's faces. Sometimes the mother and father weep. The child wraps them in her arms and leans across the table to tell how she would not have made it without their help. I have seen these programs. Sometimes I dream a dream in which Dee and I are suddenly brought together on a TV program of this sort. Out of a dark and soft-seated limousine, I am ushered into a bright room filled with many people. There, I meet a smiling, gray, sporty man like Johnny Carson, who shakes my hand and tells me what a fine girl I have. Then we are on the stage, and Dee is embracing me with tears in her eyes. She pins on my dress a large orchid, even though she has told me once that she thinks orchids are tacky flowers. In real life, I am a large, big-boned woman with rough, man-working hands. In the winter, I wear flannel nightgowns to bed and overalls during the day. I can kill and clean a hog as mercilessly as a man. My fat keeps me hot in zero weather. I can work outside all day, breaking ice to get water for washing. I can eat pork liver cooked over the open fire minutes after it comes steaming from the hog. One winter I knocked a bull calf straight in the brain between the eyes with a sledgehammer and had the meat hung up to chill before nightfall. But of course all this does not show on television. I am the way my daughter would want me to be. 100 pounds lighter, my skin like an uncooked barley pancake. My hair glistens in the hot, bright lights. Johnny Carson has much to do to keep up with my quick and witty tongue. But that is a mistake I know even before I wake up. Who ever knew a Johnson with a quick tongue? Who could even imagine me looking a strange white man in the eye? It seems to me I have talked to them always with one foot raised in flight, with my head turned in whichever way is farthest from them. Dee, though, she would always look anyone in the eye. Hesitation was no part of her nature. How do I look, Mama? Maggie says, showing just enough of her thin body, enveloped in pink skirt and red blouse, for me to know she's there, almost hidden by the door. Come out into the yard, I say. Have you ever seen a lame animal, perhaps a dog, run over by some careless person rich enough to own a car, sidle up to someone who is ignorant enough to be kind to him? That is the way my Maggie walks. She's been like this, chin on chest, eyes on ground, feet in shuffle, ever since the fire that burned the other house to the ground. Dee is lighter than Maggie, with nicer hair and a fuller figure. She's a woman now, though sometimes I forget. How long ago was it that the other house burned? 10, 12 years? Sometimes I can still hear the flames and feel Maggie's arm sticking to me, her hair smoking and her dress falling off her in little black papery flakes. Her eyes seemed stretched open, blazed open by the flames reflected in them. And Dee. I see her standing off under the sweet gum tree she used to dig gum out of, a look of concentration on her face as she watched the last dingy gray board of the house fall in toward the red-hot brick chimney. Why don't you do a dance around the ashes? I'd wanted to ask her. She had hated the house that much. I used to think she hated Maggie, too, but that was before we raised the money, the church and me, to send her to Augusta to school. She used to read to us without pity, forcing words, lies, other folks' habits, whole lives upon us, sitting trapped and ignorant underneath her voice. She washed us in a river of make-believe, burned us with a lot of knowledge we didn't necessarily need to know, pressed us to her with the serious way she read, to shove us away at just the moment, like dimwits, we seemed about to understand. Dee wanted nice things. A yellow organdy dress to wear to her graduation from high school, black pumps to match a green suit she'd made from an old suit somebody gave me. She was determined to stare down any disaster in her efforts. Her eyelids would not flicker for minutes at a time. Often, I fought off the temptation to shake her. At 16, she had a style of her own, and she knew what style was. I never had an education myself. After second grade, the school was closed down. Don't ask me why. In 1927, colored asked fewer questions than they do now. Sometimes Maggie reads to me. She stumbles along good-naturedly, but she can't see well. She knows she is not bright. Like good looks and money, quickness passed her by. She will marry John Thomas, who has mossy teeth and an earnest face. And then I'll be free to sit here and, I guess, just sing church songs to myself. Although I never was a good singer. Never could carry a tune. I was always better at a man's job. I used to love to milk till I was hooked on the side in 1949. Cows are soothing and slow and don't bother you unless you try to milk them the wrong way. I have deliberately turned my back on the house. It is three rooms, just like the one that burned, except the roof is tin. They don't make shingle roofs anymore. There are no real windows, just some holes cut in the sides like the portholes in a ship, but not round and not square, with rawhide holding the shutters up on the outside. This house is in a pasture, too, like the other one. No doubt when Dee sees it, she will want to tear it down. She wrote me once that no matter where we, quote, choose to live, she will manage to come and see us. But she will never bring her friends. Maggie and I thought about this, and Maggie asked me, Mama, when did Dee have any friends? She had a few. Furtive boys in pink shirts hanging about on wash day after school. Nervous girls who never laughed. Impressed with her, they worshipped the well-turned phrase, the cute shape, the scalding humor that erupted like bubbles in lye. She read to them. When she was courting Jimmy T, she didn't have much time to pay to us, but turned all her fault-finding power on him. He flew to marry a cheap city girl from a family of ignorant, flashy people. She hardly had time to recompose herself. When she comes, I will meet. But there they are. Maggie attempts to make a dash for the house, in her shuffling way, but I stay her with my hand. Come back here, I say. And she stops and tries to dig a well in the sand with her toe. It's hard to see them clearly through the strong sun. But even the first glimpse of leg out the car door tells me it is Dee. Her feet were always neat-looking, as if God himself had shaped them with a certain style. From the other side of the car comes a short, stocky man. Hair is all over his head, a foot long, and hanging from his chin a kinky mule tail. I hear Maggie suck in her breath. Is what it sounds like. Like when you see the wiggling end of a snake just in front of your foot on the road. Dee next. A dress down to the ground in this hot weather. A dress so loud it hurts my eyes. There are yellows and oranges enough to throw back the light of the sun. I feel my whole face warming from the heat waves it throws out. Earrings gold, too, and hanging down to her shoulders. Bracelets dangling and making noises when she moves her arm up to shake the folds of the dress out of her armpits. The dress is loose and flows, and as she walks closer, I like it. I hear Maggie go, again. It is her sister's hair. It stands straight up like the wool on a sheep. It is black as night, and around the edges are two long pigtails that rope around like small lizards disappearing behind her ears. Wasuzo Tiano, she says, coming on in that gliding way the dress makes her move. The short, stocky fellow with a hair to his navel is all grinning, and he follows up with, Assalamu alaikum, my mother and sister. He moves to hug Maggie, but she falls back, right up against the back of my chair. I feel her trembling there when I look up, and I see the perspiration falling off her chin. Don't get up, says Dee. Since I am stout, it takes something of a push. You can see me trying to move a second or two before I make it. She turns, showing white heels through her sandals, and goes back to the car. Out she peeks next, with a Polaroid. She stoops down quickly and lines up picture after picture of me sitting there in front of the house with Maggie cowering behind me. She never takes a shot without making sure the house is included. When a cow comes nibbling around the edge of the yard, she snaps it and me and Maggie and the house. Then she puts the Polaroid in the back seat of the car, comes up, and kisses me on the forehead. Meanwhile, Assalamu alaikum is going through the motions with Maggie's hand. Maggie's hand is limp as a fish, and probably just as cold, despite the sweat, and she keeps trying to pull it back. It looks like Assalamu alaikum wants to shake hands, but wants to do it fancy. Or maybe he doesn't know how people shake hands. Anyhow, he soon gives up on Maggie. Well, I say, Dee. No, Mama, she says, not Dee. Wangaroo, Liwanaka, Kimanjo. What happened to Dee? I wanted to know. She's dead, Wangaroo said. I couldn't bear it any longer, being named after people who oppress me. You know as well as me you was named after your Aunt Dicey, I said. Dicey is my sister. She named Dee. We call her Big Dee after Dee was born. But who was she named after, asked Wangaroo. I guess after Grandma Dee, I said. And who was she named after, asked Wangaroo. Her mother, I said, and saw Wangaroo getting tired. That's about as far back as I can trace it, I said, though in fact I probably could have carried it back beyond the Civil War through the branches. Well, said Assalamu alaikum, there you are. I heard Maggie say. There I was not, I said, before Dicey cropped up back in our family, so why should I try to trace it that far back? He just stood there grinning, looking down at me like somebody inspecting a Model A car. Every once in a while, he and Wangaroo sent eye signals over my head. How do you pronounce this name? I asked. You don't have to call me by it if you don't want to, said Wangaroo. Why shouldn't I asked. If that's what you want us to call you, we'll call you. I know it might sound awkward at first, said Wangaroo. I'll get used to it, I said. Ream it out again. Well, soon we got the name out of the way. Assalamu alaikum had a name twice as long and three times as hard. After I tripped over it two or three times, he told me to just call him Hakim a Barber. I wanted to ask him, was he a barber? But I didn't really think he was, so I didn't ask. You must belong to those beef cattle peoples down the road, I said. They say Assalamu alaikum when they meet you too, but they don't shake hands. They're always too busy feeding the cattle, fixing the fences, putting up salt lick shelters, throwing down hay. When the white folks poisoned some of the herd, the men stayed up all night with rifles in their hands. I walked a mile and a half just to see the sight. Hakima Barber said, I accept some of their doctrines, but farming and cattle raising is not my style. They didn't tell me, and I didn't ask, whether Wangaroo, Dee, had really gone and married him. We sat down to eat, and right away he said he didn't eat collards and pork was unclean. Wangaroo, though, went right on through the chitlins and cornbread, the greens and everything else. She talked a blue streak over the sweet potatoes. Everything delighted her, even the fact that we still used the benches her daddy made for the table when we couldn't afford to buy chairs. "Oh, Mama," she cried, and then she turned to Hakim, a barber. "I never knew how lovely these benches are. You can feel the rump prints," she said, running her hand underneath her and along the bench. Then she gave a sigh, and her hand closed over Grandma Dee's butter dish. "That's it," she said. "I knew there was something I wanted to ask you if I could have." She jumped up from the table and went over in the corner where the churn stood, the milk in it clabber by now. She looked at the churn and looked at it. "This churn top is what I need," she said. "Didn't Uncle Buddy whittle it out of a tree you all used to have?" "Yes," I said. "Uh-huh," she said happily, "and I want the dasher, too." "Uncle Buddy whittle that, too?" asked the barber. D. Wangaroo looked up at me. "Aunt Dee's first husband whittled the dash," said Maggie, so low you almost couldn't hear her. His name was Henry, but they called him Stash. "Maggie's brain is like an elephant's," Wangaroo said, laughing. "I can use the churn top as a centerpiece for the alcove table," she said, sliding a plate over the churn. "And I'll think of something artistic to do with the dasher." When she finished wrapping the dasher, the handle stuck out. I took it for a moment in my hands. You didn't even have to look close to see where hands pushing the dasher up and down to make butter had left a kind of sink in the wood. In fact, there were a lot of small sinks. You could see where thumbs and fingers had sunk into the wood. It was beautiful, light yellow wood from a tree that grew in the yard where Big Dee and Stash had lived. After dinner, Dee, Wangaroo, went to the trunk at the foot of my bed and started rifling through it. Maggie hung back in the kitchen over the dishpan. Out came Wangaroo with two quilts. They had been pieced by Grandma Dee, and then Big Dee and me had hung them on the quilt frames on the front porch and quilted them. One was the Lone Star pattern, the other was Walk Around the Mountain. In both of them were scraps of dresses Grandma Dee had worn 50 and more years ago, bits and pieces of Grandma Gerald's Paisley shirts. Grandpa Gerald's Paisley shirts, and one teeny, faded blue piece, about the size of a penny matchbox, that was from Great-Grandpa Ezra's uniform that he wore in the Civil War. "Mama," said Wangaroo, sweet as a bird, "can I have these old quilts?" I heard something fall in the kitchen, and a minute later the kitchen door slammed. "Why don't you take one or two of the others?" I asked. "Those old things was just done by me and Big D from some tops your grandma pieced before she died." "No," said Wangaroo, "I don't want those. Those are stitched around the borders by machine." "That'll make 'em last better," I said. "That's not the point," said Wangaroo. "These are all pieces of dresses grandma used to wear. She did all this stitching by hand. Imagine." She held the quilt securely in her arms, stroking them. "Some of the pieces, like those lavender ones, come from old clothes her mother handed down to her," I said, moving up to touch the quilts. Dee, Wangaroo, moved back just enough so that I couldn't reach the quilts. They already belonged to her. "Imagine," she breathed again, clutching them closely to her bosom. "The truth is," I said, "I promised to give them quilts to Maggie for when she marries John Thomas." She gasped like a bee had stung her. "Maggie can't appreciate these quilts," she said. "She'd probably be backward enough to put them to everyday use." "I reckon she would," I said. "God knows I've been saving them for long enough with nobody using them. I hope she will." I didn't want to bring up how I had offered Dee, Wangaroo, a quilt when she went away to college. Then she had told me they were old-fashioned, out of style. "But they're priceless," she was saying now, furiously, for she has a temper. "Maggie would put them on the bed, and in 5 years they'd be in rags, less than that." "She can always make some more," I said. "Maggie knows how to quilt." Dee, Wangaroo, looked at me with hatred. "You just will not understand. The point is these quilts. These quilts." "Well," I said, stumped, "what would you do with them?" Hang them, she said, as if that was the only thing you could do with quilts. Maggie, by now, was standing in the door. I could almost hear the sound her feet made as they scraped over each other. She can have them, Mama, she said, like somebody used to never winning anything or having anything reserved for her. I can remember Grandma D without the quilts. I looked at her hard. She had filled her bottom lip with checkerberry snuff, and it gave her face a kind of dopey hangdog look. It was Grandma D and Big D who'd taught her how to quilt herself. She stood there with her scarred hands hidden in the fold of her skirt. She looked at her sister with something like fear, but she wasn't mad at her. This was Maggie's portion. This was the way she knew God to work. When I looked at her like that, something hit me in the top of my head and ran down to the soles of my feet, just like when I'm in church and the Spirit of God touches me and I get happy and shout. I did something I had never done before. I hugged Maggie to me, and then I dragged her on into the room and snatched the quilts out of Miss Wangaroo's hands and dumped them into Maggie's lap. Maggie just sat there on my bed with her mouth open. Take one or two of the others, I said to Dee. But she turned without a word and went out to Hakim, a barber. You just don't understand, she said, as Maggie and I came out to the car. What don't I understand, I wanted to know. Your heritage, she said. And then she turned to Maggie, kissed her, and said, You ought to try to make something of yourself, too, Maggie. It's really a new day for us. But from the way you and Mama still live, you'd never know it. She put on some sunglasses that hid everything above the tip of her nose and her chin. Maggie smiled, maybe at the sunglasses, but a real smile, not scared. After we watched the car dust settle, I asked Maggie to bring me a dip of snuff, and then the two of us sat there just enjoying until it was time to go into the house and go to bed. Isn't she a nice author? There are a number of questions I'd like to put to you. I'm willing to go either way in terms of dividing up into small groups to talk about this or just getting some conversation going among us all. Let's try the whole group and see how we do. I think it'd be sort of fun to hear what each other has to say about the story. The first questions that popped out at me afterwards, after I read it, were, is there a winner? Does someone win? Is there a winner and a loser? And is there a bad and a good? The two daughters represent different poles, maybe, or different ways to be, or different parts of their life. Do you have a sense that one of them is bad and one is good? Do you think the mother, who is the narrator, after all, thinks that one of them is bad and one of them is good?
Well, I think she does start accusing the
mother. That's certainly a pretty strong indication that she has an opinion about that interaction, anyhow. She refuses the quilt to Dee, who is her city daughter, her educated daughter.
On the other hand, she's promised it. Well, she needed to refuse it, so it isn't really a judgment.
Mm-hmm.
She seems to accept Dee. I mean, she accepts her new name and all of that. She maybe thinks it's strange and doesn't understand why she wants to do that, but she's not willing to say that that's wrong or bad. And she's always accepted the differentness of Dee.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought she was kind of feeling sorry for her, like she couldn't express herself or herself, so she kind of had to stand in the paper before her.
Speak for Maggie.
Yeah, for Maggie, because Maggie wasn't assertive enough, or, you know, she was just going to let her take him, and then she was saying, no. She had to do it.
And she describes that as a religious experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I think something happened to the mother as well as to Maggie at that point.
Yeah, it's almost as if she
she increased her value of Maggie at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, that, I mean, if that was the turning point, but by seeing something in Maggie that she'd never seen before, that Maggie became even more important to her.
Mm-hmm.
If they had been able in the past to send me away to school, and that was doing something for her, but it could be that they'd never done anything for Maggie.
Mm-hmm.
Until this time. This might have been the first time they'd actually put something on the line for her.
Oh, well, Maggie so might have read. Wasn't there something where Maggie had gone to school and learned how to read not well?
Maggie knows how to read to some extent and can read slowly and haltingly. Dee is a very, very fluent reader and can read and almost use it as a weapon against them. And the mom Maggie says she...
I think Dee eventually will have a lot. And Maggie will probably only have little, and those two quotes will probably be very meaningful, or more meaningful.
Do you remember what...
My mother and Maggie shared the evening. They started bonding, chewing their stuff afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think Maggie is dumb? I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
There's an identification of values, perhaps, or too many. She saw in Maggie something of her continuation.
Mm-hmm.
She, after all, knew how to quilt.
Mm-hmm.
She did not.
Do you think that she might have thought that he had placed a sort of a monetary value on them, to not mentioning it, but having
actually,
lived
Dee
in
says,
the city and seen how many hundreds of dollars they were.
Dee exclaims, Mama, they're priceless.
That's right. And there's a monetary, she's become educated in the world of money.
I think the most moving life was that Maggie said she could remember grandmother's
health quote. Mm-hmm. Do you think Maggie's dumb? Mm-hmm. Are there any clues about that that come to mind? I mean, Maggie was halting. Maggie was hiding behind the door even before Dee got there. Mama, how do I look? She asked. She had on a pink sweater and a red skirt, and she was hiding behind the door. Her mother could barely see her to say how she looked. And she was in the kitchen most of the time, during most of the time after Dee got there.
Oh, yeah, but the whole interaction with the name, Maggie had a comment to say. I mean, she was kind of, in some ways, I thought she was kind of making fun of their name change, that for her, you know, this was stupid. Didn't make any sense. And in some ways, I thought that Maggie had a clearer understanding of her identity and heritage than Dee did. And that may be what the mother experienced in that time.
Mm-hmm. Like, who remembered the roots of those pieces from the butter churn? Mm-hmm. Who remembered which tree? Who'd done the carving? You know, who remembered which squares out of the quilt? That was all Maggie. And remember, Dee makes a crack. She's got a mind like an elephant. Mm-hmm. So Maggie's got a memory for all this heritage and all this stuff in their family history. You know, it was your aunt so-and-so's first husband so-and-so who carved it out of that tree that was in their yard when they lived at, you know. I mean, not all of us remember all of that stuff.
I feel like Dee was making a strong point about the heritage of Maggie, which is just in a more natural way. I mean, Dee was making a statement.
How many of you identified with either of those characters? Do you feel like, how many of you identify more with Maggie as being a natural kind of a link, next link in the chain? You know how to quilt or whatever the equivalent is in your family, and you know the history, and you live pretty much like they lived last generation. Is that how we are these days?
I might like to be, but it's really hard. I mean, I would love to do to learn how to do all of the arts that we're losing, you know, crafts and things. But I don't.
Yeah, I live in Chicago.
I can look at myself as sometimes being a greedy person that wants to have something that, you know, I have had, at the same time I can see myself carrying out something.
I have quite a few family heirlooms, and I go through this. There are some that come, they see them. Oh, I see this, you know, in the east. I have my children that live in the east. And antiques are very valuable. I live in Iowa. I love to get some of those antiques to take them to the east. I like to keep them in Iowa.
Yeah.
There are museums all about in Iowa, you know, now. Because we're aware that the people in California and in the east are very hungry for these antiques, and they're even going over to Europe. So we're establishing small museums in small towns to hold our antiques. And I have relatives, and I have nieces, nephews. Of course, they look at my gray hair and they think, well, I won't be around very long. So I can tell the difference. There are some of them that like them because they belong to my mother. Mm-hmm. And I'm of Norwegian heritage. Maybe they came from Norway. They definitely like them for that reason. But there are some that like them for the monetary value. And it wouldn't be surprised if they would be sold. But they're like the deed.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. I mean, you have to kind of see through it.
In Chicago right now, big business, booming business, is ethnic shops and stuff like Andersonville, which is a Swedish town there. It's got about 4 Swedish paraphernalia shops. They import tons of stuff, extremely high prices, and it sells fast. I mean, those places are crowded with people purchasing their heritage.
One relative said, now, if you ever have a sale, this relative lives in the east, wire me or call me because I want to come. You know, well, they have lots of money. They could outbid my children. They could outbid everybody, you know, if I had a sale. So I don't, you know, I could see that it really isn't of interest to them, only that they'd love to have that certain piece, you know. But not from the standpoint.
Yeah.
I can also see all of the characters of crap from John Clayton going to his happy because I'm a selfish rejection of that which is familiar with historical, and then as I get older now I'm more of an acceptance of who I am, and then I walk his pictures and familiarity.
Remember that she offered Dee the quilts when she went away to college.
I think it takes our children until they're about 40 before they get an appreciation of the thing. That's what I found with my
40?
Yeah. I think that's
true. In fact, my daughter-in-law said, Mom, don't give the children things ahead of time because they don't really appreciate the value of it. And they will when they're older. She said, I've just now begun to appreciate things like that.
They have to have children of their own. Mm-hmm. And then these children are wanting their things. And then they begin to realize there's a lineage there.
Mm-hmm.
The quilt kind of became an affirmation, I think, for Maggie that her mother valued her, how she was once smiling and happy and content and not hiding even after that moment.
That's right.
And one can't help but wonder if she actually used them or because of this incident.
Put them in a drawer.
Save them also.
Yeah. Well, now there's another heritage that's going on here in this story, which is the African heritage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the names and the hairstyles. What do you think about that? Is that precious? Is that is it fakey for her to be trying to leap a couple generations back or leap across the continent? I mean, when I go to Norway to look for my heritage, is that the same as, and my name is Ingrid Christiansen. You know, what's different to be called Wangaroo, whatever?
I think that some of that same searching after your heritage. And I think maybe the mother didn't quite understand it as much, and that's why I don't think she thought of either Maggie or Dee as good or bad or wrong or right. I think there's a value in each one, and this is where Dee was finding her, the need, you know, what she needed at that time. Not on.
Well, an awful lot of black folks are doing that these days. Mm-hmm. You know, you, especially the names and doing... in Chicago, there are a lot of schools to reclaim heritage for children, to teach them about the values that have come through from Africa, from different states or countries there, to familiarize the kids with it and make them feel comfortable with that heritage.
There's another statement you've made, I think, in the book, The Women of... What was that? The Women of G Street or something like that? And that's maybe... Is that the same writer?
No.
What's that?
Gloria Naylor.
Okay, well, anyway, that she makes. That says when the young daughter has taken up the African name and everything, and the mother comes to visit, and how she says, we have a proud heritage, and goes back several generations there, too. And that was pointed out here, I think, in her mother and her mother's mother and her mother's mother, and they mm-hmm. could go back several generations. And I think what they're saying is be proud of who we were now. There, you don't have to go way back to some pretend king to find the name or pretend tribe. You can, because they didn't have a way of tracing to a specific tribe, did they?
Oh, I think some do.
But the fact is that we don't have to have our identity there. I think the mother was saying that this is good enough. We know our heritage here for many generations.
Do you think maybe the mother was saying that? Do you think Alice Walker was saying that? Who is, after all, manipulating the mother to say what she's saying?
I see in her a very practical, the mother is a very practical person. I mean, Dee is coming and takes the churn and the quilt not to be used, but to be decorative items.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think for the mother, if they're using the churn, which it sounded like they were, mm-hmm. she had to put a plate over it because she took the lid.
Oh, yeah, the clabber was in it.
Yeah, and I would think she would see that as a very strange thing to take something that's useful mm-hmm. and relegate it into a decorative item.
Especially when the butter hadn't been made. I mean, how are they going to finish making the butter?
We've been Dee for a long, long time. Why all of a sudden is Dee not a name that's hereditary, that you have to skip way back to another time to get a name? Get what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That Dee is a name.
Is your
heritage. Is your heritage, yes.
I think she's trying to make a point here. I don't want to be named after anybody that's pressing. So you have to get some pretty wild name.
So she felt like Dee yeah. really wasn't.
Right.
Well,
her
mother's more practical than her husband is.
Well, yeah, a Northern European or European name and not an African name. I mean, she has a point. She's right. And certainly they were kidnapped and brought here, and so any name from the kidnapped land, I mean, if we were kidnapped and brought to Africa and given African names, we would feel we had some longing to reclaim some other kind of name. I mean, there's a lot of power in a name and in words. I thought the mother was quite sort of even-handed and okay about it. I mean, she tried, she studied the name, she made an effort to learn it, she learned it, she began to use it. Dee said, you don't have to use it. She said, why not? If you want me to use it, I'll use it. Fine. I mean, she was really pretty good about it, I thought. And she had a hard time with Hakim Abarber's name, so Hakim simplified it some, and then she used that. She joked about it a little bit. She didn't want to lose who she was, and she's, after all, a little sardonic. But she used it and adjusted. And also when the dress, you know, she got out of the car and the dress, she said that line that still sort of rivets my attention every time I read it, is this, she was hard to see because the sun was so bright when she got out of the car. She was just dazzled by it. And then that dress in oranges and yellows and radiating heat so that her face felt the heat from it. And then as the dress was floor length in all this heat, a long dress. And then as she got closer, the mother said, and I like it. I like the dress. You know, and I thought, this mother's pretty progressive. She's pretty, seems flexible and sort of hip about stuff. And she's very funny, I think. I mean, this mother's got a very, she's very observant of her daughters and wise in many ways and poetic in her descriptions of her daughters. I think she's really a tremendous, powerful woman. I'd love to know her. And the way she describes herself, when she's setting the stage at the beginning of the story, first of all, she sets the stage literally in front of the house. And they do that Japanese thing of raking the sand so that it has even lines like a Japanese garden has. It sounds elegant. It sounds beautiful. And, you know, they have three rooms in the house, so it's small, and it's nice to have that extension. So the first two paragraphs are setting the stage and saying Maggie will be nervous when her sister comes until her sister has left. And then the next several paragraphs are the mother telling us about her imagination being on Johnny Carson and having
the... That's right. Yes, dear.
And being 100 pounds lighter and considerably lighter in skin color, and how her daughter's going to pin an orchid on her, even though her daughter has told her she thinks orchids are tacky flowers. She has this whole very articulated, worked-out fantasy, and she's going to be so charming with Carson that he's going to be outdone by her. You know, this mother is funny, and she's also got a good view of herself. I mean, she's sort of observing herself going through this thing at the same time as she's going through it. She's nobody's fool, I think. She sees herself changing in this act with her children. I mean, this scene that's being played out here. And kind of gives us two points of view. She's both doing and watching herself do. Because she's the narrator, so she's telling us a report on this event. And then the first third of the story, fully the first third of the story, is this mother setting the stage one way or another. She's telling us, anticipating what's going to happen, feeling these conflicts within her of her two daughters. She's excited, she's afraid, she's worried. She almost blames Dee for that fire. She doesn't quite go that far, but Alice Walker almost leads us to believe that Dee had something to do with setting that fire. Because she sat back and was so delighted to see that house burn down. And that child, and she wasn't torn apart with pain watching her sister being quite badly burned in the fire. So that was sort of a heartless, I mean, a description of a heartless sibling. But later we see more, I think, sensitivity between the two girls, and I think that changes. One line that jumped out at me this time reading it was when she says, it was Grandma Dee and Big Dee who taught her how to quilt herself. Who taught Maggie how to quilt. She stood there with her scarred hands hidden in the folds of her skirt, juxtaposing those two sentences. These hands of this child, Maggie, are competent quilting hands. They know the history is in those hands. They know how to do it. But the hands are hidden because they're scarred in the folds of her skirt. So that deep history of how to quilt and doing that quilting is there, but also the history of that fire 10 or 12 years ago, which was really traumatic for Maggie and has left her scarred. So it's like layers of stuff that is all these layers of history are impacting on this moment when these three women come together. I think she does this layering in of history all through the story, but the first third of the story is her reflecting on history, and on her dreams, and on her understanding of her two daughters, and anticipation of the tension when those two daughters are in the same place, which is an interesting device. I think it's a mother's point of view in a way. I mean, you can understand it if you're a mother that you don't want your daughters to hurt each other. Alice Walker said about this. Do we have time? When she was talking about this story herself, this is going to be hard for me because this print is so little. Here it is. See if I can ream it out, as she says. I was curious to know why people in families, especially black families, are often cruel to each other, and how much of this cruelty is caused by outside forces, which I take it to be this history, such as various social injustices, segregation, unemployment, etc. Family relationships are sacred. No amount of outside pressure and injustice must make us lose sight of that fact. In the black family, love, cohesion, support, and concern are crucial, since the racist society constantly acts to destroy the black individual, the black family unit, the black child. In America, black people have only themselves and each other. Those were her comments about this story. So the cruelty, she says, is caused by outside forces. In what sense is that true in this story? You know, the D has the outside force of being on a rising tide of affirmation for black women. She got sent to college on a scholarship. She got good jobs. We need, you know, for quota systems all over the place. Black women were suddenly starting to be able to make it. And she says to her little sister, you know, the times have changed. It's a different time for us now. So that's an historical force that's affecting D and destroying the family, separating them, driving them apart. Another historical force is the reality of life in poverty-stricken rural Georgia. In that home, those people didn't have another way. They didn't have access to money. They didn't have access to probably electricity. And that's a reality that if you go to rural Georgia today, you will see. That's not changed. And the poverty of poor schools and racism and being cut off from the opportunity to make it in life is still stone real for those people. And so that is destroying the family. And yet, with all of these forces going on, historical forces, social forces, in contemporary America, and these, given all of that, these three people are doing pretty well.
You know? I think that final scene of there on the porch chewing is an indication of that.
Mm-hmm. Really feel good about themselves, mm-hmm. and they're sure. And this
really
will
feeling good.
I still think that in that, like, making the decision that the younger daughter has the quilt, she is kind of identifying, claiming her identity of where she is now and not wishing she were on Johnny Carson and not being, wanting to be part of the new world and not going with the daughter's new ideas of, yes, it is valuable to keep it. And I hope she does use it for her children and wears it out. It's just kind of an identity that she's grabbing hold of. Here's where I am and this is the real world and we're going to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they are contentedly together
mm-hmm.
in that. Maybe Alice Walker didn't mean to say that, but to me, it's maybe later in the book, does she not follow through on that? Or it almost seems to me like
it's a short story, so that's
okay.
It. It's not an excerpt. At the beginning of the story, she says that Dee had written to them and said, I will come and visit you wherever you are, but I will never bring my friends there.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of the fact that that was... Why did Alice Walker put that in there?
She did bring that in.
See? She did bring a friend. So we're not given a D that is static. We're not given a D that's frozen in time. We're given a D that's in process herself and probably in a fair amount of struggle herself. Now, I don't know if she's going to end up with this guy with the rope. You know, he sounds kind of...
But she's committed. Because she'll visit them wherever they are.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it also shows her commitment, regardless of whether she agrees or disagrees or doesn't get her quilt.
Mm-hmm.
I think that commitment is there, and, mm-hmm. and that, I see, is the underlying strength of the family.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And she's, when she leaves, she may be hurt. Her feelings are hurt. She leaves the house immediately. She doesn't go for the second best quilts. She leaves the house, but she doesn't get in the car and roar out of there. She stops, and they kiss goodbye, and they talk about a couple of things, and they leave in dialogue. I mean, Dee can't stay there. Dee can't go home again. She can't go home and stay there and live with them and chew snuff on the front yard. But she can be their sister and daughter, and she can come back, and she can be part of their life in interaction with them. And I think that was pretty clear at the end. She says, you know, you can make it to her sister. You should try changing too. But she doesn't really, I don't think she really expects that to happen.
That's everybody's, in almost a sense, everybody's story who leaves home, is that you're changed and you can never come back and fit in the same way.
Mm-hmm. And there's some pain in that. I think she had some pain. I think Dee had some pain. I think that the mother really loved both those girls.
I don't think there was a loser.
And I don't think there was a loser.
But there was pain on all sides.
There was pain on all sides. I think that's right. And I think that we were given a trick bag in a way. I mean, Alice Walker sort of, when you play that one through the first time without thinking about it, it kind of feels like Maggie was a winner and we like Maggie better and the old ways are better. But then when you look at what Alice Walker really said in that story, you see that the old ways are one thing and the new ways are another, but it's all part of life and it's all part of who we are, and there's old ways and new ways and in-between ways, and it's just stuff you got to deal with. So I think she really gets us dealing with it all in a way that's real productive more than anything else. So I have my hat off to Alice Walker on this one. Thanks a lot.